Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our guest today is a dear friend of mine, Dr. Justin Frank, or Justin Frank. He practices and teaches psychoanalysis in Washington, D.C., where he is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the George Washington University Medical Center. A clinician with more than 30 years' experience, Dr. Frank has been a columnist for Salon.com, DailyBeast.com, and continues to be a frequent contributor to HuffingtonPost.com on topics as diverse as politics, film, and theater. Dr. Frank employs the principles of applied psychoanalysis to assemble the kind of psychological profile used in his previous best-selling book, Bush on the Couch. In his upcoming book and his recently published book, Obama on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, he does the same thing. Dr. Justin Frank, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I should say welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, because you've been on before.
Yes, I have.
Well, you're on today because...
The early days of
Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Yeah.
So you're on because you just published a new book called Obama on the Couch, which I guess, I don't know if you could call it a sequel to your book, Bush on the Couch. But first of all, before we talk about your new book, why don't you tell us a little bit about Bush on the Couch and about your methodology, because I think it's relevant for your new book also.
Well, it's an old methodology called applied psychoanalysis, which is taking psychoanalytic principles and applying the principles of psychoanalytic work, which was originally pioneered by Freud, applying that to working with people who you don't get to see in your consulting room, like public figures, sometimes even fictitious people. I mean, there have been lots of psychoanalytic studies, say, of Hamlet. But we're familiar with the political figures. Everybody knows, for instance, not everybody, but lots of people know that Lincoln was depressed, that there have been several extensive psychoanalytic studies about President Lincoln, and it involves really finding out everything you can about them, which means in Obama's case or in Bush's case, well, in Obama's case in particular, he had written two autobiographies, so that is a lot of information. Plus, there's all the things you get to watch in press conferences, speeches, behavior, public behavior, actions as president, all of that. So it's essentially looking for patterns, looking for different ways, different things like that to help understand the person better and really think about them. The CIA does it all the time now with hiring psychiatrists and psychoanalysts to analyze foreign leaders. And Roosevelt himself, when he was president, hired a psycho. He was the first one to start this in political world. He hired a well-known psychoanalyst named Fritz Redlich to analyze Hitler, because he thought that he'd like to know how to deal with Hitler should they have to negotiate after the war. Neither of them lived through the war, so it never happened. But the book is printed. So anyway, that's what I do, and it's actually very interesting, very thorough, a time-honored technique.
Well, it must be, on the one hand, easier these days because you have more, of course, video and audio and material, but then that must also make it harder because you have more video, audio, and material to go through.
You've got it exactly right. And it is easier and harder. The mass of material and information, and he gives these weekly Saturday broadcasts, and so did Bush, but he does much more public appearances than Bush did when he was president. So it is a lot of material. And there's no way for it to be comprehensive, but, you know, that's always been a problem with doing analysis, because I only hear in normal situations when I'm working with a patient intensively, sometimes 5 days a week, I still only hear what they tell me about. So I don't know about their life for the rest of the day except what they tell me. So
right.
in a way, their analysis goes on their own, too. So with Obama, it's actually harder because there's so much material, and I have to start selecting things, and that's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just got your notice the other day that your book was coming out, and so I had my producer Mikey arrange this interview, so it was very quick. I haven't received my copy of the book yet, so I have to admit that I haven't even looked at it.
Okay.
But tell us about, and I'm waiting for it. I'm actually waiting for it.
They had a thing where they said that they couldn't deliver it overnight to a P.O. box, and I should have called you to ask for an address that I could have gotten given to them, but I've been so swamped myself.
I'm sure you have. So.
But I will, I think, so why don't we talk about it
now,
and then why don't, if you read it and like it, or are interested, or whatever, even though don't like it, maybe I could come back in a month or two or whenever you want, and we could talk about it again, because I know you'll have interesting observations. I know you too well.
So, pretty soon it's going to be Cindy Sheehan on the couch.
Well, I don't know about that.
I won't like that.
But I don't do that with people I know, so you're safe.
Okay, cool. So anyway, let's talk about, tell us about the book. Tell us about Obama on the Couch and what you concluded.
Well, the book is slightly different from Bush on the Couch initially because I really liked Obama and I was really frightened of Bush. And I actually thought he was psychologically unstable and dangerous, which I think history has borne out. Whereas Obama, I felt like I don't have to see a psychoanalytic study as a kind of weapon to warn people. It's much more of a chance to really think about someone and get to know them and look at some of their issues. But the motivation for the book was that I was actually stunned, and this may be more about me than about Obama, and I don't think you were stunned, actually, so we could talk about that.
I have to say that I'm not surprised by what's been going on the last 3 years, but I am a little stunned at how it's actually even worse than I thought it was going to be.
Yes, I think so, too. And I was stunned by the discrepancy between candidate and president. And I was trying to understand what that was. I mean, I knew when he was candidate that he was not a real liberal guy. I mean, I know enough about that, and I studied that. So that was not a surprise to me that he even took on people like Geithner and Summers and those people. But the surprise to me, and what's in the book, is about his paralysis at times. Like when there's the oil spill, he doesn't react.
Mm-hmm.
Or when there's things happening that are terrible, he doesn't react. And there's this disconnect between that and this methodical campaign where he just went after Hillary, then he went after John McCain, and he was clear and focused and strong. And then even when he had Bin Laden murdered, it was like focused and decisive, and he did it in this calm, cool way where he was at the press club the night before and joking around, and it was the night it was going on. So he was amazingly focused, and yet when he's dealing with Republicans, when he's dealing with his own party, when he's dealing with Congress, he seems tentative and indecisive and almost paralyzing. In fact, Gail Sheehy, who read the book and wrote a blurb on the back, said that she thought he was neutered.
Mm-hmm.
She used the word neutered. And, that's after reading the book. But that's what I was beginning to, what really bothered me. And so I wrote this book looking into why he is like this. And one of the things that I figured out is that the way he used the word change and the way we understood, we meaning most people understood change, was dramatically different. Most people felt that he meant change away from Bush and change right. away from Bush's policies like war, like Guantanamo, mm-hmm. like economic dishonesty and unfairness, like tax breaks for the wealthy, all of those things.
Right.
Environmental, you know, how Bush ignored the environment and ignored the Kyoto Accords. So, I mean, the change meant a change away from that, it mm-hmm. seemed like. But that's, I don't think, what he meant. In researching him, I don't think that's what he meant by change.
What well, he meant by I say that an awful lot. You know, I say that change could mean so many different things to so yeah. many different people.
Absolutely.
And even though he didn't mean change away from the Bush policies, to me, I think that he was very happy to let his supporters believe that's what he meant.
I agree with that, and that I agree with. He was very happy to be what, you know, we call in my field a projection screen, a blank screen where you project your own hopes and dreams and wishes. And he allowed himself to be that, and I think he actually, I agree with you, he was very happy. He even said he liked that. But
well, yeah, he did actually say that, right?
He did say that. He said that yeah. at one point. Yeah, I don't remember mm-hmm. where, but he did say that during mm-hmm. the campaign even.
Right.
So I think in that sense, he liked the mystery and being a blank screen, and he liked, and he knew he was, in that sense, manipulating people. I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I didn't write about as much in my book as I did that he did mean change, but he meant change in a way that's very idiosyncratic to him
mm-hmm.
because of his upbringing.
Talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about what you found out.
Well, first of all, the change he meant was change towards civility, where people could actually have dialogue and discuss. And that's why he became a community organizer originally. And that's his interest. His interest is in getting people to see what they have in common. That was his speech in 2004 about no red states or blue states. It's been a focus. Even when he made the announcement about bin Laden, he ended that brief announcement with something about we're all in this together kind of thing. I mean, he talks about that every chance he can. So why does he do that? As a child, he was, first of all, biracial. So he was had a black face, and he was raised in a surrounded by a sea of white faces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is his father abandoned him when he was a baby, abandoned the family. Not when he was two, like people are saying, but when he was a baby.
Uh-huh.
And then his mother remarried, and then he had a stepfather that he was really close to. And the stepfather taught him how to box, how to defend himself. The stepfather, he even writes about his stepfather was like the ground he walked on and the air he breathed. I mean, he was really that intensely involved with him. And then his mother took him away from the stepfather when he was 10 with the overt reason, and probably I don't know why fully, but the overt reason was she felt that her son was becoming too Indonesian and wanted him to become more American and go
uh-huh.
to back American school. But so that was a second broken home. In other words, so he grew up, by the time he was 10, he was from two broken homes. He never had a father after that. He had a father that he yearned for. He met his natural father only for a month when he was about 10. And that was it. So the next father figure he had, I think, of any deep meaning was Reverend Wright. And that's much later in his life.
What about his grandfather? Wasn't he...
No, his grandfather was there.
Spent a lot of time with his grandparents?
Yes, and he spent a lot of time with his grandparents, but his grandfather was a drinker
mm-hmm.
and was not very focused and was sort of dismissed as an authority figure or as a wise person by the grandmother, let alone by the son, the grandson. But the grandmother was strict and there and focused. So she really helped raise him a lot and was very much involved with it. So he didn't have like nobody there.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, his mother, the irony is, though, that his mother was there in a way that was really inconsistent, because she was there, and yet she also abandoned him to pursue her own interests in anthropology when she went to these remote Indonesian villages. And at one point in the book, I came with this thought that he really had the struggle with dealing with his feelings about his mother, because he adored his mother, he needed his mother, and she was the only person who was really just so intimate and tense with him, and at the same uh-huh. time, he was probably really angry at her for uh-huh. pushing him, but also for leaving him. She would push him and then leave. So I started thinking about that. And I was wondering, I don't know what your kids did, you know, I mean, because your son was killed, so it's very different. But I don't know how your kids, can't remember how old your other kids were when you started traveling and speaking out.
Well, they were in the, they were all,
out of
19 and above, but
still they had some. They were out of high school.
They still had some difficulties with the dramatic way and traumatic way our family life changed.
Oh, it was really dramatic and traumatic.
Yes.
And I think that what happened with him was that he was a little boy, and he had no siblings at the time. I mean, he didn't have a sibling until he was 9. And, I mean, so he didn't have, what your kids had for growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then his mother would not be around, and so he never protested his mother going away. I had this idea that why couldn't he say, I opened a restaurant when my son was 6, and man, was that dumb, and I'm a psychoanalyst.
Uh-huh.
I was gone a lot. It was
uh-huh.
really dumb. And Joey said to me at one point, what's more important, Dad? A dad or a restaurant? A boy or a restaurant? What's more important,
uh-huh.
a boy or a restaurant? And that has stuck with me. And that was the last day I cooked in the restaurant, by the way. I just said, you're right.
The way our society is that, there's very few families that are untouched by financial difficulties or other stresses that really are pressing the average or normal American family, or the 99% what the Occupy Wall Street movement people will say. And, we know that what they call, a so-called a family with mom and dad at home, and, dad working, mom stays home, and
those
it's a happy...
they're the exception to the rule.
Yeah, so we're probably, from now on, going to be facing this with just about anybody that runs for president now or seeks the office of president. And do we do when it's probably not the man that or the woman that really is in charge of the empire? What do we do when the empire is so diseased?
Well, first of all, there's more than one way to be away. It always hurts a child or the mother or the father when they're not spending as much time with them or when they leave. It makes them
mm-hmm.
feel bad. Makes everybody feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the necessity is the necessity. But there's more than one way of attaching to your children and for them to attach to you. And that is, there's lots of different terms for this, and I didn't really get into that in my book, but I think it's important, very important, which is, like, one is called anxious attachment, one is called dismissive attachment, and another one is called, pursuing attachment. I forgot what it's called now, even. But it's like, one is where you always want more. You always go after your mother or your father for more. Or the dismissive one is when you get your feelings hurt and boom, you just cut yourself off and you don't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happened with Obama. Mm-hmm. And I think it doesn't have to happen that way. That people who are working and are busy and are trapped by our disease system and everything have to work to make ends meet, and they're, you know, we're in a system that's just not a good one right now. Maybe it never was, but it's now seen right. coming to fruition.
Can I just give you, like, my impression of Barack Obama when I had a sit-down meeting with him back in 2005?
Yes.
And then have you like comment on it, because we unbelievably only have a few minutes left.
Oh,
but,
no.
Yeah, okay. I know. It goes by so fast. I can't believe it.
I thought it was an hour. I didn't know.
Oh, gosh. No. It only works out to be about 25 minutes.
Oh,
for the
God. Okay.
Interview.
Tell me your impression. I would have been more succinct. Okay.
No, it's okay. No, it's been fascinating so far. So, and then, of course, we'll have you back on after I read your book, for sure.
Good.
So, after Camp Casey in 2005, I was pursued by the Democratic Party. They recognized the power of the anti-war movement in the United States at that point. But my meeting, I met with everybody. I met with, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Harry Reid, John Kerry, some Congress people, a lot of Congress people, both Democratic and Republican, and they were very open meetings where their staff would be there, my staff would be there. My staff, you know, really
know
was just
staff.
my sister who ran behind.
I know your sister. She's great.
Yeah, and half the time her stupid phone would go off, and she had the Benny
right.
Hill theme music on it, and I would look at her and go, really? You know, by now you're not turning your stupid phone off. But anyway, then there would be press and everything. Barack Obama insisted that it would just be he and I. No press, none of his staff, none of my staff. And
he was the only one who did that.
Yes, the only one who did that. And you also know me very well, that when I'm out on the protest lines, you know, it's shorts and a protest T-shirt. And
yep.
So I had been going from Crawford, Texas to Washington, D.C. It took us like 3 weeks to get there, stopping, flying, you know, very busy. And so I'm still mostly in my protest attire. And I walked in, and the first thing he did was criticize the way I looked. And then he was very, very sarcastic, very dismissive of my input. And I got the impression almost the same as when I had was face-to-face with George Bush,
it sounds very much like him.
Yeah, was that, it's an arrogance and also, like you said earlier, detachment from humanity. Of course, I got the same impression from Hillary Clinton, and
yes.
Most of our elected officials are, to some degree, bought, but a lot of them still have an ability to empathize with people, but I didn't get that feeling from George Bush or Barack Obama.
So interesting. Now, I have a question. Was this when he was already president, or he was candidate, or he was a senator?
No, he was, it was in 2005, so he was just...
Oh, so it was early. It was before he even ran for the Senate. Oh, no, he was
No, he was in the Senate. Yeah, he was a senator at that point.
Right.
He was also the superstar of
right.
the Democratic Party, too.
Right. So this was in 2005. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm a little speechless. I want to think about that because the thing that I've thought about him, and maybe he's different from the way he is, I'm curious how he is with men and with women,
mm-hmm.
because I think he's seductive not in a sexual way, but seductive in a way that people feel really listened to and attended to. But I wonder if he's more seductive with men that way, and he pays attention to them and he listens. Because I know several people, but they're women too, who said they've never met a person who listens better than him.
That wasn't my experience.
No, not at all.
I mean, as soon as I walked in the door, he was on the attack, attacking my appearance.
God.
And then, of course, it was the whole, we're going to do this, just, you know. And then so when he was campaigning on transparency, I thought that was pretty ironic, just considering my own personal experience with him, was that
right.
Our meeting couldn't, like, it was just he and I, and you know, of course, there's no record of our meeting or anything.
I'm aware now of time, and you got me worried, but I've got to say this, Bush taught me that national politicians, especially national ones, whenever they say something about a major idea, you always have to think that they also mean the opposite. So when he says, I'm a uniter, not a divider, you have to think that he's a divider.
Right.
And when he says, I'm compassionate, conservative, you have to think he's not compassionate. Well, I thought that way about Obama when he said transparency, that he means he's not transparent. But I didn't focus on that because I was so struck by this, what I call an obsessive bipartisan disorder, that he has to have everybody get along, and that blinds him to everything else. It leads him to be paralyzed. But I think you're right about transparency. And even change, you could say, because at one point I was writing the book and I was saying, well, maybe it should be called Change You Can't Believe In, or Change You Shouldn't Believe In. And I did have a chapter, I do have a chapter in the book that says he's afraid of change.
Well, I can't wait to get your book, Justy. And can you tell my listeners how they can get a hold of their own copy or contact you if, you know, they have any questions or comments
I have a website called Justin Frank. That's very simple. Or Obama on the Couch, either one, .com. And it tells all about contacting me and all of that. And there's reviews of the book. The way to get the book, the cheapest way, if you have a computer, is Amazon, because it's listed 26 and they are selling it for 16.
All right.
Bookstores, you can get it in any bookstore, and it also comes in e-books, you know, in terms of Kindle and all that stuff. So you can get it in any form you want, and it's available widely. It just came out, so you're interviewing me the day after the book was released. So this is a very immediate, and it's the longest interview I've had, even though you had to cut it off. So that's how you get the book, and it's pretty straightforward to get. It's got, one of the things that's different about it is it's got a chapter called Our Obama and a chapter called Their Obama. And a lot of that, those chapters are focusing on the people who supported him and the people who attacked him in the beginning, and thinking about their psychology and what he means to them. And the second thing that makes it different is that there's a glossary of terms at the end. So reading it, you're not stuck with psychoanalytic stuff. It's actually
jargon.
It's very readable. I think it's very readable. I hope.
Well, your book, Bush on the Couch, was a super interesting and fast read. So I'm really looking forward to my copy. And Justy, my friend, as you are my friend, my personal friend, how's the family?
The family is good. My middle son, Abe, is in Los Angeles making money by tutoring kids for college boards, for SATs, to pay his rent so he can write screenplays. So he's a struggling writer. And my oldest son, Joey's made, I haven't seen, I guess you knew he made a movie and won Sundance Grand Prize. So I'm very proud of him and the Sundance
Film. No kidding.
Yeah. It was a documentary about Brazil and about corruption in Brazil.
Wow.
And it's really good. And then my daughter, who you know, Ginevra.
Yeah.
Well, you knew Joey, too, the oldest, the firstborn. Ginevra is finishing up her senior year at the University of Maryland. So they're all, you know, moving along. And Heather is great, and she's got this big job, so she can't work for the book or anything because she's now vice president at USA Today.
Wow. So, and if now that the book is finished, then you should be in better touch.
I will definitely put her in touch. I guarantee you, Scout's Honor, I will.
Okay,
Friend's
Jesse.
Honor. Okay, Cindy.
Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, talk to you soon. Love you, too.
Okay, bye.
That was our guest, Dr. Justin Frank. I hope you check his book out. Well, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, you for listening, and Dr. Justin Frank for being our guest. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.